Investors Chronicle.
Welcome back to the Companies and Markets Show. On the docket this week, Bellway, Burford Capital and Tesco as a safe haven, perhaps. Let's get going. Companies and Markets Show, welcome back. Thursday, 31st of March, as we record. Delighted to welcome back to the podcast, Gemma Slingo. Hello, Gemma.
Hi.
Good to have you back. Alex Newman.
Hi, John.
Hiya. And Mark Robinson. Hello, Mark.
All right there, John.
Snowed in. Snowed in.
Well, it's not too bad today, but it was snowing when I got back last night.
It's crazy. I literally was like, last week, I was like, are you guys all enjoying the weather? And now this week?
Yes, 18 degrees back to freezing.
I think it's only appropriate this quarter ended on such a sort of cold, miserable note.
Mm. Yes. Is April the cruelest month, though? I can't remember.
I don't know.
Sorry, I was bringing T.S. Eliot again, not for the first time.
A poetic start to the podcast. Lots to discuss today, but before we do, we're going to go into my news roundup. Lots of companies news this week. Fashion brand Ted Baker have rejected takeover bids from private equity firm Sycamore Partners. Sycamore's latest offer valued the company at around £250 million. That's 138p a share. That was on Monday, so we await further developments. A few banking lines. The government have sold to below a 50% stake in NatWest after a £1.2 billion share sale. Meanwhile, across the metaphorical street, Barclays Bank revealed an unexpected £450 million hit to pre-tax profit due to, and I quote, a complicated issuance scheme involving two traded securities going spectacularly wrong. Monday's Today's Markets article on the IC website for more detail on that. Just search Today's Market and that'll come up there. Elsewhere, grocery price inflation is at a 10-year high. The 5.2% in March is the highest level since April 2012, according to Kantar. Sainsbury's and Morrison's have seen market share decline as the price squeeze sends shoppers to discount supermarkets. We'll be hearing about how Tesco is faring a little later in the show. The FCA have fined the Swiss asset manager GAM Holding more than $9 million for three transactions, two of which were related to collapsed lender Greensill Capital. Conflict of interest policies were not followed, says the FCA. And Trainline has cut commission on tickets from 5% to 4.5% and consequently seen a 20% jump in share price, though they still trade almost 50% lower than this time last year. And finally, for me, it's been a turbulent quarter for global markets. Neil Wilson has a good roundup in Thursday's Today's Markets article on the IC website. But in a nutshell, and at time of recording, the FTSE 100 is up around 3% for Q1, a much stronger performance than its peers. The DAX down 7%, for instance, and S&P 500 down 3.5%. Right, time to dive into our topics for today. First up, our company results spotlight of the week goes to, drumroll please, British house builder Bellway.
Indeed.
Luckily for us, Mark Robinson has written these up and is here to tell us about them. What are the headlines, please, Mark?
Well, I haven't got any. I mean, not as such. But what sort of interested me about Bellway's results as much as anything is that they managed to keep growing margins against an inflationary backdrop. I mean, the period was to the end of January, so they'd have caught a certain portion of the inflation that's come through since the last quarter of last year. And so, you know, that in itself is quite interesting. The company says that it believes UK house price growth will continue to outstrip cost increases. Although I have some doubts in that regard. Of course, the reason for you know, we've seen inflation costs, they've been increasing exponentially in recent months, certainly in terms of the construction industry. A lot of this is to do with the commodity prices, and there's a strong correlation to US dollar value. So although the US money supply, you know, while the US money supply remains at record levels, inflation will continue to bubble up, I believe. The only caveat there is if we see it may slow and slow appreciably, but it would take a sizable fall in aggregate demand in the global economy to put the brakes on. And that's obviously why further rate rises are expected. I went in to point out in the article that rates, as they are still very low from an historical perspective. So even if we get a couple of further quarter point rises in historical terms, we're still well below the 30-year average, which I think is 7.2%, or I can't remember the figure, but it's something along those lines for the base rate. Will house price inflation keep on going? I was talking to a friend of this of mine the other night about this, who's got a number of investment properties. And he was pointing out that there are many people out there, many homeowners out there, many investors for that matter, have never really been privy to falling house prices or property prices. And he was talking about the situation that developed in the early 1990s, when there were so many homeowners and investors that found themselves in a negative equity position. It's hard to imagine that happening in the near term. But the thing about it, I don't think that's necessarily due to the structural drivers of, you know, we've seen there's been a shortfall in housing starts for years now, and that's one of the structural drivers of the industry. Just demographics point to the fact that demand will continue to outstrip supply. But as I say, I don't think that's necessarily the reason why we're seeing growth in this area. I think it's much to do with currency debasement as anything else. I mean, we had a decade of more than a decade of quantitative easing, and now we've got that. Finally, that inflation has been unbottled and is coming through as the money supply has expanded as rapidly as it has done. So really, it's house prices aren't really reacting to the normal market dynamics. Well, that's my view anyway. Nonetheless, you know, Bellway's order book has increased by about a quarter during the half year period, and it's also significantly increased the value of its land bank. Probably a question again: is this growth sustainable given the outlook for interest rates? Well, we'll find out in due course. One of the other things I noticed about within the results as well is there was obviously a reference to the set aside for the Grenfell Tower disaster. I think Bellway had to put another £22 million to that effect, bringing the total up to about £178 million, I think it was.
187, I think you've
187. Yeah. Okay. But you know, that's been well covered in the press. But there's another issue which actually might feed into construction costs again, and that's linked to professional indemnity insurance. Because what's happened in the wake of the Grenfell disaster is that more and more contractors and their suppliers have become litigious, trying to work out, you know, what's the old adage, where there's blame, there's a claim. And so this has increased, and insurers now are seeing increased activity in the wake of the disaster and the subsequent inquiry. So we're seeing a substantial increase in the number of notifications being issued to insurers by contractors and designers up and down the country in relation to aluminium composite material, the crux of the problem there at Grenfell. And so while you're seeing this rise in notification and actual claims, it's causing insurers to look at the premiums being charged as well as the type of cover being offered. Some insurers are actually withdrawing from that professional indemnity insurance market or changing the basis of policies. See, the bottom line is that it's likely to feed into construction costs. Already we've seen problems in certain boroughs linked to social housing and the cost there, with some projects being cancelled outright. So, you know, if you're in that position, you're going to have to, if you're a contractor, you're going to have to ask yourself, you know, will an indemnity policy renewal even be offered by your insurer? And you're going to wonder about the premiums themselves that may eat into your bottom line. You know, can you even afford the premiums? And should you just let the policy lapse and start again in order to amend the scope of a historical cover? It's a real conundrum for the industry now, and it's another reason I think why costs will continue to bubble up. Just what it's worth remembering as well that the UK isn't quite so bad as other locales in the world in terms of affordability for housing. That relationship I talked about last week between median incomes and average house prices, the UK is in a better position than some other countries. But there's obviously a limit, you know, when you've got real wages shrinking, that multiple becomes, it intensifies effectively. So there you go. I've put the kibosh on the construction industry.
Mark, the thing I thought was really interesting about your, I mean, just the you writing up the results was that, I mean, they're now trading at a discount to their net assets, which, I mean, okay, they face lots of issues, not least of which is a slightly unknowable provisions they're going to have to make to, you know, for fire safety remediation and as you said, any insurance fallout that might come. But I mean, they sit on a land bank. They're in a net cash position. They still have mid-teens returns on equity, and yet investors basically think that their assets are going to lead to a negative return going forward. So it's just amazing, really, to see the state of the house builders at the moment in investors' eyes. They just think they really seem like they're pricing them in to be primed for a crash. I mean, you put them on a buy. I don't know if it seems like you agree with that. That it's a bit overdone.
I quoted actually the erudite voice of the last person to cover Bellway, which is your good self. Then you said that the lowly rating leaves room for missteps, some unexpected headwinds, and solid returns. It's just a question of being able to balance volume growth with high dividends for shareholders. So, I mean, I don't know. It's a forward yield of about 5.5%. But, you know, if experience is anything to go by, then the market's probably right and I'm not.
Thanks so much, Mark. So that goes down as our result of the week then. Bellway, and you can find the write-up in the IC magazine and on the website, done by yourself, Mark Robinson. And let's move on to another company who've just released an annual report, and that's Burford Capital. The litigation funder have posted its first pre-tax loss of almost $60 million, something that's been brushed off by Burford's chairman. Jeremy, you've covered Burford for us, and I wonder if you could break down, well, firstly, maybe what they do, and then, you know, also some details of this report.
Yeah, so sort of in very simple terms, litigation funder finances legal claims and takes a share of the winnings if the case succeeds. So in many cases, funders might pick cases that would otherwise be too expensive to get off the ground, for example, because the legal fees were just too expensive. One example would have to be sort of the recent case against the Post Office, which was brought by a private funder, actually, but gives sort of a little insight in how they operate. So the Post Office case puts funders in a really excellent light in a variety of ways, but I think it's a tricky industry, which is evident in Burford's latest results, really. So, as you said, Burford posted its first ever loss of almost $60 million. And they sort of attributed that to timing issues. So because litigation takes ages in the UK and the US, and COVID has caused even more holdups in the court system, they basically said they hadn't had the cash flowing in like they would have done in a normal year when cases reached a conclusion and they got paid. And as you said, they were very optimistic and tried to brush that off, really. But it is an important problem in the sector. Because there are only a few handful, really, of listed litigation funders, but cash flow is extremely unpredictable, and the outcome of litigation is also very unpredictable and hard to judge from an outsider perspective, I suppose. You know, if you're not a lawyer, you can't make any meaningful judgment on whether a case will succeed or fail. But another thing to mention, I think, with Burford is questions that have been raised over its accounting methods. So obviously there was the Muddy Waters attack in 2019, which it vigorously defended itself from and denied all of the allegations about its accounting methods. But it's something that analysts raise a lot with the sector, basically because it's difficult to gauge how well companies are doing. And the cash flow can be so sort of lumpy, it's hard to know actually what returns will really look like. So I think the results this week really sort of throw that into the spotlight.
I think, Gemma, you said in the piece as well, you kind of highlighted, I suppose, what the attraction of the share case is, that they're, you know, it's these sort of alternative asset, which is uncorrelated almost to the, you know, the vagaries of the stock market and equity risk premium and things like that, because you're basically backing their legal expertise, aren't you, and their ability to pick cases which are going to return, make a good return on investment. But I mean, just looking at your write-up, which I thought was, you know, a really brilliant summary of the numbers and the, I suppose, the reason, you know, the reason for, if not concern, then I suppose some of the reasons that there might be a bit of skepticism lingering about the model is that all those factors which are assets for the business, i.e. its ability to its ability to fund this new market, are also potentially downsides in that you have very little limited visibility over, as you said, what you know, when the returns are going to come, how much cash is going to be generated. And, you know, their investment, I think, in Peterson, which is the big Argentina arbitration claim, is, you know, still over $1 billion of assets on the balance sheet. So, you know, there's huge concentration risk still in their ability to turn assets into cash. So
yeah, it's a tricky one to call, because in many ways it's quite an exciting industry, because certainly the English court system seems to be far less suspicious of third party funding than it was, say, a decade ago. And there are these sort of huge class action claims coming through the system which are funded by these types of company. And I was also looking into the role of big data in litigation funding, and companies are starting to bring together huge amounts of court data to try and predict the outcome of cases, which I imagine might become a theme that we see as the years go on. But it seems sort of quite a capricious industry as well, which makes it hard for to get a real grasp of what's happening.
You mentioned the Muddy Waters attack 2 years ago, and I think a lot of our readers and listeners will remember that. But maybe you could just briefly explain what that was precisely.
Yep. So it was in the summer of 2019, I think. And basically, Muddy Waters, which is a short seller, raised doubts about Burford's accounting model. And at the heart of that was this question of a disparity between sort of the profits that Burford was reporting and its cash generation, and basically how it was booking its unrealised gains. So were these profits actually real, basically? Mm. And Burford reacted very, very strongly and defended itself vigorously from that. But it has raised important questions about just the industry as a whole, I think.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting. Alternative assets, just sort of betting on the outcome of cases, I guess. But they do have a good strike rate, don't they, I think, Burford?
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, they from the cases that they've picked and have concluded, they've got a knack of picking the good ones. So I think it's a 93% return on invested capital figure that they quote in their latest set of results. And they're quite keen to stress that they combine sort of specialist human legal knowledge with this big AI database. So they do seem good at picking them. It's just how the litigation actually progresses, really.
It's, I thought it was interesting as well that they, I mean, you point out recently they made another sort of big slug of investments in cases, but they're chasing a slightly lower internal rate of return. So the, historically it's been about 30%, but now they're going after sort of the 12 to 20%. I thought it was interesting that it's either a sign of, you know, maybe more money chasing cases, or just they're looking to balance their risks a little bit more and go after things which a bit more predictable. It's kind of still hard to say, isn't it? Mm. You know, without seeing the full details of.
I think as well, because it's becoming more competitive to get suitable cases, because these funders have typically gone after huge value cases because they offer the biggest returns. But because more people are fighting over those now, some are changing tack a little bit and opting for smaller cases where you have to invest less, but obviously you get less money back. But I was talking to someone recently who suggested that the sector might start to operate more like a stock market, where lawsuits are basically grouped together into portfolios that people can invest in, rather than just having, for example, a huge class action where it's win or lose and you might lose it all. So that might be an interesting thing to watch.
Yeah, I think what was so there's a securitization aspect, isn't there? But then also, I think one of the analysts was suggesting that they're encouraging Burford to become more of an asset manager. So they have this, like, they do this work for sovereign wealth funds, don't they, on this kind of manage claims on their behalf. But I think it's Peel Hunt saying that they should do this at a greater scale, because in some ways it reduces the capital drag on their own balance sheet, doesn't it? But
yeah.
You know, I mean, interesting if they go that way, or they're happy to stick with deploying a lot of their own money.
Yeah. And it seems that they're wanting to make third-party funding normal in, for example, like a corporate legal department,
yeah,
whereas it hasn't ever been in the past, particularly in the UK. I think the US has a slightly different legal culture.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Gemma. It's a very interesting sector, very interesting company. I'm sure you'll be all over their movements, whatever's to come. Okay, finally for today, and as promised earlier, I wanted to talk about our high street grocers. Highest price inflation for a decade. Although as you wrote earlier in the week, Mark, Tesco looks like a viable safe haven. Why is that?
Well, I just thought it would be, at the moment, the way things stand within the economy, it's hard to capture a lot of growth out there. And I suspect that many investors will be looking at ways to preserve their capital through any downturn in the offing. And there's just a couple of questions that I asked about Tesco. The first one, I think, was like, will logistics play a larger role than price discounting during the current inflationary period? And as you say, is the company still a solid defensive option? And from talking to other writers at the IC, the respective answers seem to be no and yes. Tesco at the moment, its price is up by a fifth over the last 12 months or so, but it's only at the level that it was just prior to the first lockdown. During that time, in common with its peers in the market, the grocer expanded its online offering and its delivery service. And there was also costs linked to ensuring that its staff and its customers were safe during the period. I mean, this is a well-known narrative now. During that period, it secured a larger customer base. And earlier this year, Kantar produced some stats suggesting that sales are up by about 10% on a two-year basis. But more importantly, Tesco also picked up market share, up by 60 basis points to just under 28%, which is a significant move from that perspective. You know, but the trends that informed the strategies during the pandemic, they've given way to considerations how Tesco and other supermarkets will contend during this, you know, high inflation or rapidly rising inflationary period. And I posited anyway that Tesco might be better placed than most due to the expanded logistics function. You know, it's a market leader in that regard in terms of capacity and arguably expertise too. And that, I think that's the main reason why it's still a viable defensive option under the current circumstances. You know, one of the primary considerations, obviously, is the ability of retailers or grocers to pass on increases through to shoppers themselves. And it's debatable whether the big German discounters are any better place than the likes of Tesco to do this. Tesco has what sounds to most people a really narrow net margin, 1.3%, but that stacks up well against many of its competitors. So, you know, we can say it's got a little bit of flexibility in that regard, and there's still share price upside in the offing as well. So, as I say, I'm not entirely sure that its logistics function or its superior logistics function places it in a superior position to peers at the moment, but it's certainly worth considering. And that's all I had to say about that.
Great. Well, Mark, you're taking. Do people know you're taking stock, or is that like a secret?
The secret's out. His face is right next to the.
It's not like Marvel Comics. I mean, the name. I don't think my name is. I'd rather keep it under the radar as well.
Mark, your face is on every Taking Stock, I'm afraid, in the print mag. So Bruce Wayne, you ain't.
I've been unmasked. Yes. Anyway, well, as I say,
our online only readers know now as well. So yeah, the secret is fully out. But yeah, that was your Taking Stock column this week. Tesco safety in numbers.
Next week I'll be writing about Intel. That's something to look forward to.
A sexy topic. Thanks very much, Mark. And thanks, Gemma. And thanks, Alex. And thank you, listener, for sticking with us. And we'll catch up again with you same time next week. So we'll see you then. Thank you. Companies and Markets Show was edited and produced by me, John Rogers. Don't forget to head on over to iTunes, search Investors Chronicle, and hit subscribe for us straight into your feed. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next week.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.